The mistake, though, is thinking that AI is a solution for strategy. And if you try and outsource your strategy to AI to come up with a creative marketing campaign, that's not how these LLMs function. They are literally trained on the past. They cannot invent the future. And good marketing invents the future.
Hi, welcome to Path to Growth. I'm Tracy Young, co-founder of TigerEye. Today, we are joined by Kyle Coleman, Global VP of Marketing at ClickUp. Kyle, welcome.
Hello, Tracy. How you doing?
Thanks for joining us today. So to start, tell me about growing up in Rhode Island. Tell us about mom and dad and what you learned from them.
Well, my dad was in the Navy, so I grew up kind of all over the place. I was actually born in Hawaii and then moved to Italy for a little while where my little brother was born. And then he got stationed or restationed in Rhode Island, which is where I grew up. And it's a great place to live. I recently just moved back here. So I was on the West Coast for a little while, and then I was in Colorado. And then I had a son of my own, and my wife and I are both from here, and her family is all rooted here. And having that support network for a year and a half old son is really helpful. So we've been back here for about a month or now, and so far so good. It's a nice place to live.
Yeah. And, you know, as a working professional and parent, it's so important to have the multi-generational family where the grandparents and the aunties and uncles and cousins are in the children's lives. So I'm really happy for you guys.
It makes a big difference. And it makes me really have a different level of appreciation. I thought I appreciated what my mom did raising three sons without any of that social network or family network. And now I know, or I feel like I have a much better appreciation for it. It's like borderline superhero territory to be able to do all that stuff alone. It's really pretty remarkable.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about what you learned from mom.
God, that's a tough question. The list is very long. I would say the main thing is resilience. It's the main thing. And I think it's really an important thing, especially as I started my career in sales. You know, if you're only failing 99% of the time in sales, you're doing something right. It's crazy. And if you don't have that thick skin, and you don't have that resilience, and you don't have that confidence in yourself, not necessarily to get something right the first time you do it, but to have the confidence that you're going to learn and be able to do something well, that I think is something that I learned from my mom. She's like, jump in, run toward the fire, try and figure something out. And the journey of solving a problem is the most interesting part of life. And that's a big lesson. I owe a lot of my career development to that kind of mindset.
And resilience is so important. I've seen so many people, you know, really talented, smart people who have just been unable to deal with failure and then who just gave up the first time they failed in their lives and just couldn't find that resiliency. So I'm glad.
100%. And as what I always tell people, especially people that are earlier in their careers, is looking back on my career, I don't remember the easy stuff, Tracy. It's not like I remember the thing that you solve in an hour and you move on. You remember the stuff that is hard. It's the stuff that took you days or weeks or months sometimes to get right, or the thing that you put in maximum effort and it was a total dud and you had to rebuild from the ground up. Like, those are the types of things that you really remember. So I feel like many people have this aversion to hard work, or they feel like if something is hard, it's a failure because it's hard. And I try and make sure that people understand that that's no way to live life and certainly no way to grow your career. So that resilience, I think, is a really important thing that seems to be somewhat absent from the way that a lot of people approach their work.
It's so true, especially in marketing, where there's never a silver bullet. At least I haven't found one, right? It's not like I can just spend money on this one thing and I'm going to have all this pipeline. I've got to try a dozen things any given time just to get enough pipeline to feed the sales team. And so much of it is just having the courage and audacity to be as creative as you can and to try something new and to see if it works. And then if it doesn't, to just tweak it or try something completely different and over and over and over again.
100%. And, you know, there's always, or not always, but often there's some opportunity for some arbitrage for some channel that hasn't been figured out or cracked by B2B marketers. And so you can get in early and you can sort of have a first mover advantage on these things, but it always evaporates. And as soon as something starts to feel like a silver bullet, that's when everybody else figures it out. And then the advantage goes away. So it's a constant evolution, and it requires equal parts creativity and analysis and a real understanding of what are we doing that's really measurable? What are we doing that's really repeatable? And how can I apply a creative process to that to do it over and over and over again in different forms so that you stay fresh and you stay consistent and you keep that same brand promise, but you tell the story in different ways that compels an audience to take action. It's a very hard nut to crack.
So tell our audience, what is ClickUp?
ClickUp is, so have you ever used it before, Tracy?
No, I haven't.
Ah, okay. So ClickUp traditionally is thought of as a productivity platform. And you'll hear people talk about task management and you'll hear people talk about project management and all that stuff is very important. And ClickUp has built a wonderful business on that. I joined 4 months ago. And the way that I think about ClickUp is actually quite different. And forgive me because I'm going to go into a little bit of marketing-y speak right now, but I think it's important as I work this idea out in real time. ClickUp is a truly converged workspace. And what I mean by that is I kind of draw the distinction between bundles or like suites of applications before, like the productivity suite that you get from Microsoft is Word and it's Excel and it's PowerPoint and it's OneNote. It's all those things. And they're not really connected. It's a suite. It's a bundle. You get a price discount when you buy all of them. Great. Microsoft 365, I have it all. And that's been very useful. But what ClickUp is offering is more of a converged workspace that is pulling together these previously distinct work apps and truly intertwining them and integrating them so that your chat and your docs and your projects and your forms and your whiteboards are all accessible by one another, learning from one another, incorporated with one another, and then layered with AI that's doing a lot of the connective tissue. So ClickUp is this converged workspace that is everything that people need to get work done. And most popularly used by project management pros or by marketing pros. A lot of like IT teams will use ClickUp for product launches and things like that. Finance teams use it for RFP processes and contracting. The use cases are incredibly horizontal. And it's because of all of these various apps converging into one workspace that makes them really usable.
So businesses can really, truly run their business completely on ClickUp.
Yes. It's basically, a lot of people will think about it, Tracy, as a development platform for whatever use case you want to build. And something that was very surprising to me as I was researching ClickUp before I joined is how popular it is as a CRM in SMB businesses. I just had never thought about it before. But then I thought about, well, what is a CRM? Well, it's a kind of this collection of tasks or rows that have some interplay or relationship with one another. And of course, you can build that using ClickUp. And you have all the context right there and all the docs right there. And so it makes a lot of sense that instead of spending however much you would spend on a HubSpot or Salesforce or whatever deployment, you can do this kind of in an ad hoc way using ClickUp. And we're starting to see so many incredible use cases just because of the development that you can do on top of the platform. And then, as I mentioned before, that confluence of all these apps that then has compounding value.
Right. So it sounds like there's a lot of flexibility for customers to customize this to their workflow and needs.
Exactly right. Exactly
really right. Cool. And as an SMB, like you're not turning on Salesforce. I mean, at least you shouldn't. You're going to have to hire a team of people to configure it and like administer it.
That's right. And HubSpot is better in this respect. But even still, there's a lot of price sensitivity. And if you can build something yourself, that's a hell of a lot better than a spreadsheet. Like use ClickUp for it. If you're using ClickUp already for much of your task management, project management, or documentation, or a lot of people use ClickUp's chat instead of using Slack. So if you're already using ClickUp, then try out the CRM. We have a template. You can go and install that template in literally 10 seconds. And now you're off and running with a CRM that's perfect for SMB and mom and pops.
So you've led marketing at several high growth companies. How has AI tangibly changed the way teams operate today versus just a few years ago?
Yeah, it's about speed of execution for me, Tracy. Specifically around, let's just use campaigns as an example, because campaigns are cross-functional, they're multidisciplinary, they're creative, they're analytical, they're basically all the things. From your marketing strategy to your creative deployment, your content, your demand generation, marketing ops, and then your sales team. And in the past, executing a campaign was quite it required a lot of orchestration. And there was a lot of planning that went into it. And there's a lot of handholding that goes into it. And then there's a lot of like bottlenecks that end up happening. And getting any campaign out the door is really difficult. Now with AI, what's been really amazing to me is how much friction you can remove from that process. So I'll give you like the easiest example is when you're planning a campaign, often you're going to have whoever, four or five people in the room, and you're talking about what are the goals here? What is the audience? What's the main messaging and all the rest? And then somebody takes that meeting and 3, 4, 5 days later comes back with the campaign brief. Now you have that live meeting. AI takes that transcript and creates a campaign brief in literally 30 seconds. And you can go and start executing immediately instead of having to wait however many days it used to take a person to turn that around. Now, of course, that campaign brief needs to be reviewed by a human, and AI is not going to be perfect. It's going to miss some things, and your live meeting probably didn't cover every angle, but the time that it takes to execute is compressed from however many days to however many hours, and you can find an opportunity for that kind of time savings and compression basically everywhere across the marketing engine.
In the last few months, I was able to meet with, well, several public company CEOs, but two of them specifically told me the same thing, that their plan was to double revenue and bookings in the next few years without increasing their team. So they plan on having the team stay the same size, but double their business. And they really believe that they would be able to do that with AI. What's your take on it? You know, you are a marketing leader. You've got, I'm sure, demand gen folks and product marketing folks and field marketing, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, you're talking about the productivity increase by leveraging AI. How do you think about like growing your team with the use of AI?
I think it's absolutely possible to achieve that outcome that those CEOs are talking about, increasing growth, increasing top line, increasing productivity without significantly increasing your headcount. The mistake, though, is thinking that AI is a solution for strategy. And if you try and outsource your strategy to AI to come up with a creative marketing campaign or to come up with new original thinking or to come up with some way of like, it's just not, that's not how these LLMs function. They are literally trained on the past. They cannot invent the future. And good marketing invents the future and gives your target audience a vision of where they need to be and creates a visceral pain around the status quo, and then offers a unique solution that's your product or solution or technology or whatever that gets people from this current painful existence to this new existence. I've seen companies or people try and run their entire marketing department with AI, and the outcome of that is always very bland. And yeah, they'll get a million SEO optimized blog posts, and yeah, they'll get a million different ad variants that'll perform okay on social or whatever. But if there's no real meat or no real wood behind the arrow, and there's no real creative marketing strategy, and there's no real visceral pain point, and your human sellers are unable to actually sell against any of that vision, you're creating a lot of work and potentially creating a lot of pipeline that's never going to go anywhere. So long way of saying, yes, outsource what you can to AI, but don't outsource strategy. You need to find the people who have the right balance of being strategic thinkers that can connect the dots and being really good operators who know what good looks like and can measure and perform. And if you find one of those people, they can do 5 times, 10 times what a person could have done 2 years ago with the new technology that we have.
Yeah, it's so fascinating. Even in the market that we serve, which is all the analysts and rev ops and marketing ops folks that use our product, and also C-suite, of course, but it's really the people who are munging numbers on spreadsheet that TigerEye can, we can just do that work for you. But what we're seeing is that there's just this widening gap between the really good analysts and rev ops analysts and sales ops and marketing ops analysts and then the mediocre ones.
Yes.
That AI can do a lot of their work in seconds. But what we can't replace, and not, nor that we are aiming for, is replacing the strategy behind what to do next. Like, we can provide all the insights, we can provide you with any trend line analysis and historical performance review. And we can, of course, make suggestions, but at the end of the day, it's going to take real leadership with an L and real tactics and real execution that requires humans to execute on.
100%. Sales is the same way. AI is going to come and replace what mediocre sales reps were doing. What are mediocre sales reps doing? They're doing the lazy stuff. They're collecting the low-hanging fruit. They're doing the things that will get them to 60% of their number, like monitoring product usage signals and then actioning those signals and getting that small upsell. Hey, you're using 100 licenses. You're only contracted for 90. We need to go sell you 10 more licenses. That stuff is totally replaceable by AI. What the best sales reps are doing is they're connecting the dots. Why are they using those licenses? What other behaviors have we seen? What can I find about their CEO posting on LinkedIn that's going to indicate some strategic initiative that that company has? How can I connect this overutilization with that strategic initiative and go and actually sell something that's tops down? How can I layer my solution into their corporate planning so that I can command more value and be a trusted consultant to this company? Like, those are the types of AEs that are going to do really well. And of course, AI can help with the signal monitoring type stuff, but the human connecting the dots is still so important. And you'll see this proxy, a proxy for this kind of like the mediocre person versus the superstar person replicated over and over and over again. And my hope and my contention and sort of my AI optimism is that AI is going to help create more of these superstars. It's just going to take a little time for people to figure out what great looks like, because it's not something we've really had time or energy to train against before.
I gave a talk at a go-to-market conference recently, and we did a Q&A session afterwards. And I talked about, basically the punchline of my talk was, AI is not going to replace people, but people using AI is going to replace people who don't. That's the bottom line. You've got to figure out how to use AI to supercharge your skills and deliver much more for the company because you have this tool now. And when the Q&A questions came up, there's a lot of marketers that raise their hand, and there's obviously a lot of fear saying, you know, that sounds great and all. It's just that I've got a lot of marketing friends that are on LinkedIn who've been looking for work, and they've been unemployed for months now, right? These are experienced marketers. What is your advice to, I don't know, folks in marketing, folks in sales? Like, what skill sets should they continue developing in this new age of AI?
Yeah. And I definitely have empathy for those people. Like, getting a job is never easy. But what I have experienced as we've been hiring people across the marketing team here and demand team and marketing ops teams and SDR teams is the exact paradigm that you just mentioned, Tracy. I have interviews with people and I ask them what their perspective is on how they will incorporate AI into their day-to-day. And if they don't have a perspective on it, that's a major red flag. And this is everybody. Like I meant, even SDR, individual SDRs that are fresh out of school, sometimes have the best answer because they just spent the last 3 years in universities like figuring this stuff out. So I feel like if you're not learning how to become an AI native, it's the same exact thing as in the late 90s, early 2000s. If you just turned a blind eye to the internet, you're like, I don't actually think I'm going to use that internet thing to do my work. People be like, what are you doing? What? Come on. Or before then, if like you're not going to use a computer, you're not going to figure out how to use a spreadsheet, and you're just going to do all your sums by hand in tables. It's like, why are you ignoring this technological wave that is happening? So it is a mandate. It's what companies are looking for. And the interesting thing, and I mentioned this arbitrage moment, is companies don't know what good AI deployments or good AI employees look like. So you, people that are on the job market, you can train them on what good looks like. Here are the things that I have done to become super well-versed in AI. Here are the tools that I would need. Here are the workflows that I would impact. Here's the cost savings that I would bring. And you can have a very robust perspective on this. It's just a matter of exposure, and it's a matter of you leaning in. And the people that are doing that and bringing that to the table proactively, they're the ones that are getting through the interview process. I basically guarantee it.
Because the output is the same. I mean, yeah. The quality is the same. And if you can laser focus on what were you doing before that you can now trim to like seconds and still have the same output, that's incredibly powerful.
100%. And so like, and what that requires, Tracy, is you have to have a really strong perspective on what good looks like. If you don't have a good perspective on what good looks like, then you can't use AI to reach it. Like, you need to know the destination in order to draw the map. And I think that once people understand that everything that you do at work is a process. You're getting from A to Z somehow. And some of these processes lend themselves to automation and some of them don't. The ones that do, you need to figure out how to codify. You need to figure out how can I, maybe fully A to Z, I can't codify with AI, but I can certainly get from A, B to C using AI, and I just save myself an hour. And you can do that for all the different processes that you're running. And sooner than later, you're going to find you're saving yourself 5 hours a week, and then 10. And then 20, and then 40. It's amazing how much time you can end up saving yourself if you just really think critically about what are all of the things that I create and what are the processes that I use to create them, and where are there areas for automation? And once you start, once things start to click, this was my experience anyway, Tracy. Once I started thinking this way and things started clicking for me and I started getting exposure to what AI could and couldn't do, it unlocked everything for me. And now not a day, not an hour goes by where there isn't some workflow that's powering what AI workflow that's powering the work that I do.
Yeah, and we're seeing that over in TigerEye Engineering too. Our engineering leader just told me that AI has helped the team increase productivity by about 25%.
Amazing.
And that's amazing. And it's probably going to grow over the years. And of course, you can get AI to just give you a bunch of code, but it still takes experienced senior engineers. As you said earlier, with you've got to understand what good looks like. Our senior engineers are looking at the, I don't know, 1,000 lines of code that AI is dumping out, and they've got to be able to identify which parts are good and which parts are bad and what we're going to actually jam into our code base. And what we found is it does certain things really well, like unit testing code, and then some things it just is kind of bad at because the code is so complex. And I think the worst part is it almost looks right, but it's going to introduce so many bugs. And so again, it's going to take that senior experienced person to sort of sift through what is going to be valuable in our code base or not. And I think the same thing is with go-to-market. And I'm so happy to hear that you guys are leveraging AI to do a lot of your work. Can you give us one example of how your team has implemented AI to save real time for them?
So every week, we have a mandate where every single employee on every Friday has to submit at least one use case that they had for AI, big or small. It could be the simplest thing that saved you 10 seconds, or it could be this crazy complex app that you built yourself that's saving you 2 hours. I don't care. I just want every single Friday, everybody on the team to submit for full visibility across the whole team. Here are the shortcuts that I found, and here are the ways that I'm using AI. So we've gotten into this cadence where there's accountability from me, and I read all of these things and I respond to every single one every single week because I care about this stuff. Like if each individual member on the team isn't becoming AI native, that means that our team is not becoming AI native, and that means I'm failing as a leader. So there's accountability from the top that like give your people license to be creative and then give them accountability to go and actually report on the things that are working for them. And as a result, my mind is swimming through all of the 40 updates I get every single week on all the different AI use cases that are out there, Tracy. But it's things like for a marketing operations audience that I think we'll find interesting is like lead scoring. Traditional lead scoring is pretty imprecise because you haven't had really the data that you need to be able to do something that's really effective. But now with AI and all the unbelievable enrichment things that you can do, we had our head of demand gen. He created a lead scoring model that's leveraging a handful of different enrichment systems to get the full set of, if somebody only gives us their email address, how are we going to find out the 30 things we need about them to build a profile that then scores them? But importantly, he also put together an AI system that went through all of the historical conversion data and applied this new scoring mechanism and ensured that it was actually going to be predictive of future success. And he did it in an hour. Mm-hmm. And that kind of thing used to take a marketing analyst like a week minimum, 2 weeks probably to do, and then let alone to implement the system to actually get the lead scoring system live. To be able to do all of that in an hour is absolutely remarkable. And it's like, that's the kind of speed that you're able to find. And that's one of the more complex use cases, of course, but it's a very cool one. And that's the type of thing that our team is rooting out and inventing and inspiring everybody else to go and be like, oh, I didn't know we had access to this system, or I didn't know that AI could do this. I didn't know you could upload an image into the AI and it could read the image and tell you a trend report. Like some people just don't know. So a lot of it is about forcing exposure, and then the use cases that you'll get from the team have compounding value.
Man, I am so happy to hear this like tribal knowledge sharing and this encouragement at your company and with your leadership. I read this report recently. I can't remember who published it, but most people are hiding the way they are using AI in fear of like the stigma behind it. And it's crazy. It's just, you know.
It feels like cheating sometimes. It really does. And so sometimes you might be a little reticent to share, hey, you know, I, Kyle, wrote this LinkedIn post with AI. All I did was jibber jabber into my talk to text feature using ClickUp for 3 minutes. And I said, turn this into a LinkedIn post in the style of Kyle and it wrote the LinkedIn post. It's like, it feels like cheating because that used to take 30 minutes, 45 minutes. And now I just did it in six. It's like, it's crazy. And so I understand that people, you know, they are reticent, but what you have to realize is that you exposing your AI prowess is a means of future-proofing yourself. And I think most leaders at companies understand this. I could be wrong, but I hope most leaders at companies understand this and are searching for the employees that are leaning into this technology and valuing those people. So I hope that we're more open and there's less of a stigma because I understand that it exists, but man, it's a mandate across our team.
It's great. How do you think about building team culture?
For me, it's a lot about trust. I feel like my main role, and what I'm very open with people about, is I'm not an expert by any means across all the different functions that I manage. I'm not. I've done some of these things personally. Some of these things I've never done personally. And my level of experience is kind of up and down. And my level of expertise, if I can claim it, is high or low in certain areas. And so I'm pretty clear with people that I'm hiring you to do the job. I'm not hiring you to do my vision of the job. I'm hiring you to do the job. And my role is to, you know, help sense check and make sure the strategy is aligned and all the rest. And then just to get you the right resources that you need and get out of your way. And that comes with a very high degree of trust. And so in order to earn that trust, the headline that I have for people is your standards for yourself have to be higher than anybody's standards could be for you. And if you operate that way, and if you're really motivated to be that A++ type person, you have a good idea of what good looks like in your role. You're hungry, you're curious, you're relentless, you're obsessed with the work that you're doing, and you're effective in how you do it, you earn my trust. And I say earn, it's not an easy thing to earn, and it is sometimes an easy thing to lose, but I kind of float between where I need to allow people to earn that trust, to own a short-term project and see how they do, and then, you know, give more and more trust so that they can take on bigger and bigger projects. And that's how I try and create a culture that is a performance culture and one of accountability, but also one of autonomy. And I try and find the right balance. It's not the easiest thing to do. I'm curious though, Tracy, like how does that compare with how you do things?
Well, our core values at TigerEye include trust, wholeheartedness, and Kaizen. Yeah. And so I think it aligns a lot with your leadership style and the way you think culture as well.
Continuous improvement. Yeah, I love that.
Mm-hmm. And it's okay. It's okay for us to make mistakes. It's okay for V1 to be kind of shitty, but like, let's figure out how to make this better fast.
That's a really good point, Tracy. And I should say, like, I don't mean, and I'm pretty clear with people, like, I would rather you make a good, solid decision now with 80% of the information versus trying to get 100% of the information and it taking 2 more weeks. Because the decision quality is probably not going to improve that much. And you need to trust yourself, kind of back to what we were talking about before, the resilience, the confidence you have to have. Not that your first answer is the right one, but that you have the wherewithal to improve as you get more data. And that's a really important thing. The Kaizen mindset is critical to bring that to life.
So as a founder of a startup that often gets compared to Clari because we have automatic forecasting capabilities. Yeah. We also get compared to Looker because we have custom dashboarding capabilities, yes. Although it's way easier to do because you just talk to our AI and make your graphs for you. Tell me about just like marketing at those companies and what you wish you'd learned earlier in your leadership journey there.
Well, I'll tell you what I did learn from both of those companies, both Looker and Clari, is that marketing the problem is more effective than marketing the solution. And we, especially in tech industries, we get so obsessed with our technology and the cool things that it can do. We lose sight of the fact that no one else cares. People care about the problems that they have and how much you understand their universe and understand their problems so that you can earn the right to position your solution as the solve for those problems. But I think many people will just say, and certainly, you know, this is something that I saw happen at both Looker and at Clari, where the early marketing that we had for Looker was very solution oriented. You know, hey, we're this no code, low code sort of way of doing modular BI, and you don't need to be installed on premise. And people are like, what are you talking about? What does that even mean? And then we started talking about this problem of data democracy and this problem of data bottlenecks. And that was something that we were just relentless about. This was 2013, 2015. It was like, the problem you are facing, Mr. or Mrs. Analyst, Mr. or Mrs. BI engineer, is data bottlenecks. Everybody across the organization needs access to data. They can't get it. Your data is not democratized. Here is how Looker solves that. And that using that data, we called it data bottlenecks. We called it data chaos, where like we had that kind of verbiage that really had this visceral, it was imbued with meaning. We didn't have to describe it. Everybody knew what we were talking about. Data chaos, data bottlenecks. And that earned us the right to go and talk about, oh, here's why our cloud first technology that's going to work with Snowflake and work with Amazon Redshift, which were new technologies at the time. Here's why this is a better approach than this on-prem stuff that you're stuck in, you know, whatever system you've been using for 20 years. So marketing the problem earned us the right to talk about the solution. And we saw the same exact thing happen at Clary, where at Clary, we would talk about forecast accuracy and we would talk about these things and certain, you know, CFOs, CROs that would resonate okay. But then we started talking about this problem of revenue leak and people were like, what? And we're like, you're leaking on average 14.9% of your revenue. It's a $1 trillion problem across the US. We can help solve it. And they would say, how do you do that? Say, well, here is how. And then we would talk about forecasting. We would talk about pipeline and we talk about conversion rates. And we talk about all the wonderful roll-ups you can do inside of Clary and on. But leading with the problem is a more effective way of getting people's attention and trust so that you can earn the right to tell them about the solution. And it's interesting and it's funny because like it's the same thing in cold email. If you do that in cold email, you just only talk about your solution without really telling them or showing them you understand the problem, it's an automatic delete. And that same principle applies to every level of the marketing engine. And that's a lesson I learned early and I'm fortunate for having learned it.
Mm-hmm. And it's this way at cocktail parties too. Most people you meet want to talk about themselves. They don't want to talk about you. And so the listeners usually do better because, you know, the chance for someone to talk to you about their problems versus being sold at with a bunch of solutions they might not need is much more interesting. You have led teams across radically different company stages. Is there a difference, you know, between the small teams and like Series B teams and like growth stage teams like ClickUp?
Yeah, there are differences because there are certain specialties that have to exist or that you're fortunate enough to exist as the team expands. When you're at a smaller company, you're wearing multiple hats, like you need generalists who are very good at everything. Then you graduate into a mode where you need specialists who can go deep, deep on the T instead of wide across the T. So there are different profiles that you look for, but the great people can flex into whatever role they need to flex into. I would say the thing that's consistent is how to develop people and the right people to try and hire. And these are the people that are excited about, again, going back to what we talked about earlier, excited about new challenges, excited about the fact that something is on fire and they have an opportunity to solve it. The people who run away from that kind of stuff are not the type of people that you can really build a business with. You need the people that can, that have the motor, that have the energy, that have the IQ, the EQ to go and take on the hard problems. And if you can find them and if you can point them in the right direction and then trust enough to let them go, it's amazing to see how much that can affect your scale.
You talked about trust and the AA plus team members that are like hungry and obsessive and passionate. Are there other traits that you look for when you're building your team and hiring?
The number one trait is curiosity, but by far. I've found that it's just not something you can train. You either have it or you don't. And that goes back, it's related to the other characteristics you mentioned, like that passion, that energy, that drive, that obsession. If you have the curiosity and you have the self-starter nature to go and ask questions and get answers, you're going to do well. You're going to do well. If you just accept the status quo and you're not really interested in why things are happening or ways to improve it, you'll probably do okay, but you'll hit a ceiling. You'll hit a ceiling. And you certainly won't be the type of change agent who evolves the process or completely redoes the process to find that step change difference and make that step change impact. You might change things incrementally, but the people that make that step change impact are the ones that are hyper curious.
And when you only get to talk to someone for 30 minutes, are there signals of a curious person?
Yeah, I know it sounds super obvious, Tracy, but I think you've probably experienced this before. I always leave room in the interview and I don't wait until the end. I always leave room in the interview to see what kind of questions they have. Mm-hmm. And if they're just checking the box with, oh, tell me about the culture at ClickUp, it's like, okay. But if they have really done their homework and they've looked and they've listened to podcasts that I have done or our CEO Zeb has done or our CFO Dan Zhang has done or like and had a perspective on what's going on, has dug into that perspective, that shows me that there's a level of curiosity there and they're really trying to get something answered that they haven't been able to answer in any other tool or system. Like, you can go and find out about our culture anywhere else. There's a million different ways you can go and find about. But if you come in and you have some question that's impossible to answer elsewhere, that shows me that you've done your homework, you've connected the dots, and you have the kind of the chutzpah to ask that hard question in an interview setting. And I think that's a really interesting way to filter for it.
Yeah, we can tell so much about the questions that people ask. And you can also see the logic of how their mind works as well.
Right.
So I'm sure you've seen Glengarry, Glenn Ross.
Of course.
That stereotype of the Alec Baldwin sales leader.
Yeah.
Is there that version for marketing leaders? Like the stereotypical old school marketing leader?
Yeah, there's a performance element to a lot of different roles, because that used to be the way that you would, and to a certain extent it still is. It's the way that a lot of resources are allocated, is on a performance basis. If you can come in and you're the loudest voice in the room, and you can command a room and you sound good and you're confident, a lot of times that's how you get resources initially. Mm-hmm. But if you don't actually deliver, you don't actually have the results, then that, all of that bravado is completely, it melts away and you don't get a second chance. So yes, those profiles exist. But what I have found is that they're not the type of people that last at a company for 2, 3, 4, 5 years. They're the type of people that maybe transition into being a consultant because they're good. They sound good for 6 months and then they're on to the next thing.
Yeah. And as a founder who's interviewed, I'm going to say close to 100, if not over 100 marketing leaders, most marketing leaders by this stage in their careers are just really good at presenting themselves, right? And so it's really hard to tell what they've actually done. It's nice to have leaders who have just touched and worked on and built programs in, you know, more than one aspect of marketing, that they've been responsible for, you know, not just field marketing events, but also demand gen and obviously product marketing. What's the best career advice you've ever received?
I've mentioned it already in our conversation here, Tracy. It is something that I was kind of already doing naturally, but I hadn't really thought about it this way until it was framed this way to me, which is the person who hired me at Clary. His name is Kevin Fisher. He's an awesome, awesome guy. He's the chief customer officer there now. Back in 2019, he told me, run toward the fire and find the areas of the business that you can go impact. Even if it's something you don't think you can solve, you run toward the fire and you raise your hand and you have the confidence to go figure it out. That is going to unlock doors. And I'm really grateful for that advice, because that was my career journey at Clary. When I started, it was to lead SDR and enablement. The head of demand gen left at Clary and I ran toward the fire. I was like, hey, I saw what good looks like in my time at Looker. I worked hand in hand with our VP of demand gen at Looker, awesome woman named Lisa. I feel like I can keep the train on the tracks here on an interim basis. We'll see what happens. And they're like, okay, give it a shot. And to their credit, the leadership at Clary, Kevin, not just Kevin Fisher, but also the CEO, Andy Byrne, who's an amazing mentor of mine. I love him to death. They had the confidence in me to give me a shot, see what happened. And because I ran toward that fire and because I think effectively put it out, temporary became permanent. And then that pattern repeated itself over and over and over again until I ultimately became the CMO at Clary. And so that's my advice to people. It's not easy. You put your neck on the line. It's very performance-based. But when you see a problem, accept it as yours. Run toward it. See what you can do to solve it. And that's the way that these experiences and kind of the scars will build up in your career. And you'll have a really solid foundation for career growth. And that's, for me, that's the most exciting part of what we do every day.
It reminds me of one of the best pieces of advice that a founder friend gave me, which is really similar. And he said, go towards where it hurts.
Yeah, exactly.
Work through it. And there's usually a big reward for you. Yeah. And he meant it in business, but he also meant it in, like, I don't know, mentally and in your personal life. That problem isn't going to go away. And if you're able to just go towards it, you're going to at least learn something about
That's
it
right.
and be in a better place.
That's right. It's not just going to dissipate by itself. You know, that time does not cure all. Some things need to be proactively managed. And especially in business, like, it can be, you can die by paper cuts in the business. And so even if the problem you're solving, the fire you're putting out is a small one, it helps. And you earn the right to go do the next bigger thing that you see. So that, you know, I'm really grateful for having received that advice. And I hope, and I see myself responding really well to the people that are operating this way. And I try and give this advice to as many people who will hear it, because these are the types of people I really enjoy working the most with.
It's been such a great conversation with you, but I've got one last question before I let you go. You have an 18-month-old, I think, and, you know, being an ambitious executive and being a parent of a very young kid, what have you learned these last 2 years?
Being on the East Coast is really helpful. Most of my the people I work most closely with are on the West Coast. And so I have the mornings, Tracy, to like hang out with my kid. And like just this morning, we went to the park 7:30 in the morning. We were there until 8:30 or 9. I'm just like, I never knew this until becoming a parent, but like an hour and a half goes by just like staring at a kid, just marveling at watching him toddle around and fall on stuff. It's just like, it's amazing. And so you got to make time to enjoy the little things and enjoy watching the progress grow and carve out the time. And like, I didn't even have my cell phone. I didn't have anything. I was inaccessible. And guess what? The company survived. Like, you have to have that perspective and carve out time for the things that really matter in life. And I love what we do. And I take work very seriously. It's a big part of my identity. But nothing is better than just like staring at this baby and being like, I can't believe that this is real.
Oh, that's so beautiful. And I love how practical and specific the advice is. Work for a West Coast company that allows for remote employment.
Yeah.
And live on the East Coast. So you're 3 hours ahead and get to come online, you know, when finally everyone's waking up.
Critically, have a son who is incapable of sleeping past 5:30 in the morning. So you're up early anyway.
Yeah, I got that son too. Anyways, it's been great chatting with you, Kyle. Thanks for all the tips and lessons for our listeners.
Really appreciate it, Tracy. Thanks for having me.